Welcome to our Saturday simulcast. Ryan Newberg, Tom Dienhard, join me, Alan Karpik, and we're glad to be with you. Glad you're checking in with us again. Want to thank the Union Club Hotel. Union Club at Hotel at Purdue University is becoming part of the Marriott's Autograph Collection, exclusive group of more than 200 hotels around the world that are hand-selected for the inherent craft and distinctive perspectives on design and hospitality. We are the first, we being the Union Club Hotel, the first Autograph Collection hotel operated with primarily students from Purdue, and the second Autograph hotel in the state of Indiana. Guests of our boutique hotel can participate in Marriott Bonvoy. We thank the folks from the Union Club for all that they have done for us. And we'll start our Saturday simulcast. Brian's about to go to availability as Purdue will play Maryland tomorrow, 1 o'clock. The Boilermakers take on the Terrapins. But Brian, still, you made it home from Michigan. Purdue did not get home with a victory. But looking at that and maybe looking ahead of what you expect to see on Sunday, it's going to be a disappointing loss, obviously, the 24-point loss, but maybe just a bump in the road. How do you view it a little bit later?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was just a total malfunction on Purdue's part. I think it was just kind of one of those nights. I mean, you know, I don't want to be reductive by saying it's just something that happens, but you know,
yeah,
people have bad nights. And you know, I think Purdue was in a tough spot. I think that, you know, I don't know if this team has necessarily handled success terribly well all year long. I think, you know, concentration has been a year long kind of thing for them, and they'd won six games in a row and looked pretty good doing it. And, you know, in the midst of a long stretch of games here, this was, you know, probably rife for some sort of step backward to a certain extent. And it just came in an all-encompassing form. And I think the big lesson from it was not one that necessarily wasn't apparent before, but it's something where, you know, Purdue has too often this season just been able to score away its problems and shoot away its problems. And, you know, every time something would break down from a defensive perspective or a turnovers perspective, so often Purdue's just been able to throw a pile of three-pointers on top of it. When that didn't happen the other night, it was that proverbial convergence of everything going against Purdue, everything going for Michigan, and just kind of one of those buzzsaw moments. I think it's probably just a moment in time and not any sort of reflection of what Purdue is for the rest of the season or a reflection of what Michigan is for the rest of the season. I mean, Michigan made 9 threes in the second half out of 13 attempts. You know, part of that's on Purdue, but part of that's on Michigan just kind of having one of those nights too. It was just kind of a perfect convergence of all kinds of things going for Michigan and against Purdue. And Purdue just needs to kind of wipe the slate clean here. Take from this a stern reminder that they have to be better defensively. I mean, it is February 12th. And I thought a lot of the progress you'd seen from Purdue in that regard following the Wisconsin game many, many weeks ago kind of completely went by the wayside at Michigan. I think Michigan did some things that gave Purdue real problems on a short turnaround from their first meeting, but Purdue just wasn't very good, obviously. And I think this needed to be a reminder for Purdue that they've got to listen. They've got to pay attention. They've got to communicate with one another, kind of things like that. But also, you know, for Purdue to kind of look to see how maybe they can boil some things down here to put some of these guys in better positions, because again, February 12th, a tiger doesn't always change its stripes, you know, this late in the season. So, you know, if there are answers out there, Purdue's got to find them.
Yeah, I mean, Brian, it gets discussed often on our message boards. You've written about it. The defensive metrics, the KenPom defensive rating for Purdue in the triple digits, I believe. And there's a lot of KenPom historians out there that say teams with that poor of a defensive metric per KenPom just typically are going to struggle when you get into March especially. And you said a tiger can't change its stripes. I mean, what can Purdue do to tighten up its defense? Because the offense, we all know you're going to have off nights. Defense travels. We know all those cliches. Your defense keeps you in games. But your offense, you're going to have clunker nights. And then that defense isn't going to be there to bail you out. I mean, I guess I'm looking for answers and a reason to think how this defense is going to get better from now until the NCAA tournament starts.
Yeah, I think in terms of the public conversation, I think that number has been thrown around a lot in the context of Purdue can't win the national championship with that kind of ranking from a defensive perspective. And I think, you know, therein lies a little bit of the fly in the ointment here. I think there's a difference between how Purdue perceives things and how fans perceive things. But for this team, and it's understandable given the passion of this fan base and how Final Four hungry this place is, but everything this season in the court of public opinion has been about March. You know, instead of here's what Purdue needs to do to win the next game, here's what Purdue has to do to win the Big Ten. Everything has been about this is going to be their undoing in the tournament. And that's a legitimate, you know, concern. But that's also a month away. And this was going on in November, too. So then it was 3-4 months away, whatever it was. But Purdue has to just do better. I mean, I don't know how else to put it. You aren't going to kind of tear down your defense on the fly here. You aren't going to go to the waiver wire and go get Nojel Eastern back or Chris Kramer back or you know, whoever it might be. I think people perceive Purdue in a way that's not really accurate anymore. I think people still look at Purdue as Gene Katy Purdue, as early Matt Painter Purdue, where this is a defense-minded program. While this program is coached by defensive-minded people, it is constructed with offense in mind. It is a skill and shooting and passing and dribbling based program. It is a scoring program these days. And that is the model that has worked for Matt Painter here the last 5-6 years, and one he's now absolutely recruiting to. He's recruiting these giants for offensive purposes, knowing that there are challenges that come with playing really big. He is recruiting a ton of shooters. When a guy is a shooter and a really good defender and a guy with a high basketball IQ who can dribble, pass, and shoot and do all of the skill-based things that Matt Painter covets, those guys are going – to the NBA very quickly. Those guys don't show up very often. You have to overcome some things when you build a team the way this one is built. That being said, if Purdue got a little bit more, you know, attention probably from its personnel, if these guys were a little bit dialed in better, I can't really say here's what Purdue should be doing differently from a systematic perspective. I think their system is it obviously worked for them last year. I thought all year long last year they overachieved, and it kind of came to bear in the NCAA tournament. So I don't know if they were ever as good as their numbers last year. And I didn't think prior to the other night that they were as bad as their numbers this year. I actually wrote that thing the other day, kind of explaining off some of their defensive issues, a lot of which have lied with turnovers on the offensive end, a lot of which have come from some of the things I just talked about in terms of the way the roster is constructed, things like that. But Purdue just has to be better. I think maybe there are some things Purdue could tweak along the way, maybe simplify things a little bit. You have guys clearly who don't know what they're doing sometimes. Purdue can be really, really lost in switches at times. Purdue can be really, really lost in their assignments in terms of helping one another. But at the end of the day, it comes down to the five guys on the court keeping the basketball in front of them, the five guys on the court talking to one another. That is something that is just has been missing all season long, I think, in terms of guys just being on the same page. And if they're not on the same page, telling each other on the fly. I just don't think that this is a great communicative team from a defensive perspective. I think that can improve. I think Purdue can do the best job it can do limiting turnovers. That would really help. I think Purdue could do the best job it can do blocking out on the defensive end to limit possessions. That was a problem at Michigan too, one of 100 problems at Michigan. But I think a lot of stuff goes into this. But I think ultimately it falls on the guys on the floor really dialing into their scouting report, really paying attention, really talking to one another, and really just understanding the importance of this. It is February 12th, so it is not November anymore. But I think that's kind of where where the onus lies most here.
Yeah, I thought Matt Painter. Go ahead.
That being said, I want to make this point again. Purdue is 21-4. You know, when we harp on the things that get Purdue beat or can get Purdue beat, that is because that is the standard that has been set by how good this team is. When you are this good, your worst day still has to be just good enough, you know, and it was almost at Rutgers. It was almost at Indiana, and it was not even close at Michigan.
Yeah. I thought Matt Painter said a couple of weeks ago after the, and it might've been on his post-game radio show, not the press conference, the game against Ohio State, when the famed Jaden Ivey went the wrong way, made the game winner, was indicative or an indication of he talked about, he said, some teams that I've had, Matt Painter has had, you know, don't forget things when they walk out of the huddle. And it's not an indictment necessarily on the character of these guys, but it's just maybe a little bit of an indication of their focus from time to time and what you're hitting on and the fact that they didn't run the right play there. Yeah, they ended up making the shot. Jaden Ivey did, but it is an indication of a little bit of that attention to detail, which I think plays into defense too and being able to do that. I think, don't you think, Brian, the talent level's there to do enough of that to be good enough defensively? I mean, I just don't see that as being just a complete inhibitor to this team going deep into March if it does what it's supposed to do.
They have real limitations from a personnel perspective defensively. I'm sorry. I think my beep just went off. I'm usually the stickler on that. My fault. They have real limitations from a personnel perspective. They really do. They don't have personnel so interchangeable that you aren't vulnerable to, you know, getting caught in bad switches. Sometimes you have a lack of foot speed at certain positions. From a defensive perspective, you have ultimate size that obviously you have to work around, because there's a reason college basketball is not played as big as Purdue plays it. Purdue has to really make accommodations for that. And that's the reason their system is built around protecting the paint. It's built around helping against the dribble, things like that. And thus comes all these layers of assignments that, you know, guys often struggle with. But I think Purdue was better last season because I think they were so young that they were really dialed into listening. I have no data to support this. I have no corroborative opinion to support this, but I think that, you know, fans being in the crowd again, you know, perhaps gives people more things to look at, more things to listen to, more visceral sort of stimuli, stuff like that. And it's just, this season's very different than last season. And I think also, you know, people know how to attack Purdue too. I think obviously last season kind of presented a little bit of a blueprint for how Purdue is going to go about things defensively. And everybody saw that, and everybody saw how Purdue got knocked out of the NCAA tournament last year, things like that. Everybody knows where Purdue's vulnerabilities lie, and they're attacking that. Now, that being said, I've said from virtually day one of this season that I think Purdue, with its offensive ability and you know, the short turnarounds of the NCAA tournament and the lack of familiarity that'll come with the NCAA tournament, I think that Purdue can be a better postseason team than can be a regular season team, because the things that win basketball games in the Big Ten are some of the things that aren't necessarily the strengths of this team. They're not a great half-court defensive team. And I think that when you get to maybe a situation where people don't know you as well and they haven't had to prepare for you six times in the past 3 years or 2 years or whatever it is, I think that, you know, that can be an advantage for Purdue. I think I said the same thing a couple of years ago about the Carson Edwards team, and look what happened in the postseason. You know, all of a sudden, people who hadn't been preparing defensive game plans for Carson Edwards and Ryan Klein for three straight years didn't know what to do with them. Because guarding those guys in person and crafting a game plan off of film on 3 days prep, you know, those aren't the same thing. And I think that, you know, a lot of what has gotten Purdue beat in Big Ten play is stuff that jives with the things that maybe Purdue isn't necessarily built as much to do, even though people still look at Purdue as Gene Katie Purdue, that here's what they're going to be really good at. They're going to take care of the basketball. They're going to be really good in half court defense. They're going to play really hard. They're going to play really hard. I'm a train wreck today.
That's all right.
That's not necessarily what this team is. And I think people expecting Purdue to go out there and be a great hard-nosed defensive team, that just doesn't align with reality. That has never been the reality for this team. Mm-hmm. Purdue can be okay defensively. I thought they would be a better defensive team this year than they were last year simply because of the progression of time. I was obviously wrong. But I think this team just has to be solid. I think that's a word that just applies across the board in so many ways for Purdue. If they're just solid, if they just take care of the basketball, if they just block out, if they're just good with their assignments, if they just keep the ball in front of them, I think they can be better than they are, obviously. And they need to be, because this is problematic. That being said, 21-4 still. I mean, you're still one of the best offensive teams in the country, but when you rely on outscoring people, you give yourself no margin for error. And that obviously came to bear in Ann Arbor.
All right. News also this week, obviously, I think it was Thursday, Tom, a big, an interesting announcement, the fact that Purdue will play Penn State on Thursday. We're talking some football here. And the Boilermakers not this Thursday, but Thursday, September the 1st.
Very important.
Yeah, we don't want that just yet. But
don't show up at the stadium.
Don't show up at the stadium, and there will be snow on the ground. Though, we thought we were going to have spring football a couple of years ago, so I guess anything's possible. But the point is, it is going to be one of the biggest opening season games, maybe. I don't know. Looking back at it 30, 40 years, in terms of the fact that Penn State is a national program. Purdue's got a lot of expectations coming into this year with Aiden O'Connell returning, et cetera. What was your take, just on that? And it's going to be a huge environment for that game.
Well, I could go for some spring football, guys.
Yeah.
Get my Pittsburgh Maulers shirt out, and I'm ready.
Yeah, the Maulers.
We got Kevin Sumlin coaching the Houston Gamblers coming up here. So, but I digress. It's a great opportunity, fellas, right? So the game goes from September 3rd to September 1st. You mentioned the Penn State Nittany Lions. This will be the third time under Jeff Brohm, guys, that Purdue's opened with a Big Ten opponent, of course, beating Iowa in the 2020 season. Of course, Brohm wasn't on the sideline then, but you get the idea. And then, of course, 2018, right? The Rondale Moore debut, a game that still has people buzzing. Again, Purdue lost that game. I think it was 31-27. That was a Thursday night game.
And yes, it was.
I went back and looked. I think this is only to be the second Thursday night game, right? Friday night game against Ohio in 2017. They played Nevada on a Friday night. And I'm sure there's some others, but I think this is only the second Thursday night game. You may know better than me, Alan, but. Yeah, great opportunity, right? There's already the excitement towards 2022 began at the final gun in Nashville after that heart-stopping win against the Volunteers. Yes, Carl Loftus is gone. Yes, David Bell's gone. But still, guys, a lot to be excited about from a football standpoint. Talked about Aiden O'Connell. Tell you what, anytime he's under center, Purdue has a shot every Saturday, I think. We all know the value of a quarterback, and Purdue certainly looks like it has an elite passer here, a veteran presence, a great leader. And just look at that bowl game, right? No David Bell, no Milton Wright, and the offense still hummed, right? So again, it's a great opportunity for the Boilermakers to show. Last year was no flash in the pan, right? There may be some buzz for a preseason top 25 ranking, for whatever that's worth. It's always nice to have. But still, most importantly, guys, Purdue's going to have a great chance to knock off a marquee opponent on a pretty big stage to open up, like I said before, a 2022 season that a lot of people are excited about.
Yeah. Brian, you take that, but also the fact that Jeff Brohm, we hit this a little bit last week, I think, but just the – assistant coaching changes and then the fact that this program is now and will be in year six. And is it showing, it's showing some, maybe based on the fact that you won nine games in 2021, that level of stability and maturity and maybe that foundation is in fact built? How do you view that?
Yeah, I think you'd like to have some more continuity than Purdue's had. I think that's important for the players. I think it matters in recruiting. But as we know, this is a Brohm family run program, and sometimes the systems come and go. I don't know how big a deal it is. Purdue turned over a lot of its staff last year after they had struggled, and obviously that was successful. There's not been as much turnover on the offensive side of the ball as there has on the defensive side of the ball, so that will be interesting. But we know there is, a singular voice on the offensive side of the ball, so I think continuity probably is less of an issue there. But I think that the biggest thing for this season is you just want to keep doing what you're doing defensively. I think you took a big step forward. I think, obviously it wasn't ideal that Brad Lambert left after 1 year, but I think that the silver lining to that cloud is that if that 1 year taught Jeff Brohm what he wants, what he needs, and what can win at Purdue, and built a template for him to look for kind of in the future and make that an actual defensive identity moving forward for his program, I think last year maybe served as kind of the pivot point for this program from a defensive perspective, where Purdue's had no defensive identity for, going back to, Brock Spack. And I think if they can just take last year, build on it, and build some continuity in that regard, I think that can be a really positive thing for this program moving forward.
Yeah, Tom, you've talked about with Ron English and Mark Hagan back. I mean, yes, the Lambert loss is an important one, but you do have two guys that, it's a tone-setting thing, as Brian mentioned. You want to play a certain way. Jeff Brohm appears to know that now, or at least can clearly articulate his vision for what he expects defensively and let his guys go do it. And yet you also mentioned Ron English, maybe end up being the play caller, but you do have two very important guys back on that defense from a coaching standpoint that I would think would make a big difference.
Yeah. Brian talked about this being Brohm's sixth season. The only coaches since Jack Mollenkopf that have reached a sixth season are Joe Tiller and the great Jim Coletto. That speaks to the work Brohm's done here. And yeah, I think as far as the defensive staff goes, I think we may hear something soon on who's going to be the play caller there. Again, we've all speculated it's probably going to be Ron English. I think we'll be surprised if it's not. But again, I think we'll probably hear something on that pretty soon. And, I tell you what, David Elson, I think was a cut above hire, a guy who's been on staff, a guy who acquiesced his ego last year to take more of a quality control consultant type of a role with Jeff Brohm's defense, brings head coaching experience to the table. Was at Western Kentucky. Of course, was a coordinator in many places. Worked at Indiana in 2010 for Bill Lynch. And a very respected coach. And I when I'm told, the players respect him as well. So I think that's going to work out well. And Ashton Yabody, guys, that was the one outlier here, right? The one hire that Brohm had no connection to. Ashton Yabody was at Youngstown State. Of course, was an all Big Ten cornerback at Ohio State for Jim Tressel, played in the NFL for about 6 years. This is a guy I think that the staff, I'm told, we tried to hire a few times. And he spent some of his early coaching career at Wisconsin. You know, Jeff Brohm really respects Jim Leonard and that Badger defense a lot. So I think Brohm liked the fact that he learned at the feet of Jim Leonard at Wisconsin for a few years as well. Bring some NFL cachet, right, to the staff, which always helps on the recruiting trail. Ashton Yabody is from Klein, Texas. He was born in Liberia, but he's from Klein, Texas. And he's going to bring, they think, a recruiting presence in the Lone Star State as well. And that's an element of youth too, right? This guy played cornerback as well, obviously. James Adams was a great coach. James Adams was a linebacker at Wake Forest. So again, your Bodhi, when your Bodhi talks, it's really going to resonate with kids, right? And I think they got a good young up and coming coach there as well, who's really going to be folded in here and hopefully will be a big part of this defensive staff moving forward.
All right, Brian, we're going to move to our last topic of the day, Super Bowl, which will be on Sunday. It always is.
Are we allowed to say that term?
Yeah, I think so. It's not. I think we're using it for media purposes. So the big game will be there. But and I think I used this earlier. But again, I'm the only one that was. No, Tom was still alive when the Jets, Brian's team, won the Super Bowl in Super Bowl III. I just look at Joe Burrow as the next Joe Namath.
Oh, he now, just
I
don't took think he's my come take. Out.
I know. I did that twice in a row.
I thought that was an original thought on my part. And you just
no. I mentioned. I don't know. It might be.
I was going to say that Joe Burrow has so much Broadway Joe in him that you almost expect him to win every game he plays in. You just stole my thunder.
Well, I don't think Namath got sacked 9 times a game like Joe Burrow does. It's amazing. But no, and I just think he's a unique guy, and you obviously do too. And this will be an interesting game. So I want both of your take on what we're going to see tomorrow. The Rams come in a favorite. They're playing at home. They have a coach that said yesterday, I believe, that he's contemplating retirement at age 36. So I don't think he's going to retire right away. Talking about that work-life balance. But Cincinnati, I just think, has got an interesting team and has two Purdue players. But Brian, what say you in terms of what you expect to see on Sunday night?
Yeah, as hard as it is to bet against Joe Burrow and Ja'Marr Chase right now, I think that this feels like the Rams' time. I mean, this feels like Matt Stafford's time. This feels like Ray Bourque going to the Avalanche, Kevin Garnett going to the Celtics, them kind of boiling it in anonymity, you know, for a long time, and then going to a winner and kind of having their moment. I think Aaron Donald is the best football player on the planet, and I think this is his time to really, you know, make his case as kind of one of the all-time greats, if he hasn't already. I think they've put a lot into that defense, Von Miller, Jalen Ramsey. I think the Rams sort of have it all. And I think the Bengals are kind of riding this magic carpet ride here that, you know, is sort of kind of like running the wrong pitcher in the postseason in baseball, kind of running into a hot 3-point shooting team in the NCAA tournament, something like that. It could fall out from under them pretty quick. That being said, I don't think Joe Burrow has ever lost a high stakes football game in his career, but it's 22 guys on the field too, as opposed to just the quarterback. I think we don't always look at football that way because the quarterback occupies so much oxygen in the court of public opinion. But I just think it's the Rams' time.
Rams 4.5 favorite.
I'm taking everyone's take. Tom, as
I know. That's all right. Tom, what do you say? I have little to no take in the NFL. But go ahead.
If I was
Tom.
A bet man, I would take the Bengals in the points. Think about four and a half points. I'm going Bengals, man. I'm going Ken Anderson, Bob Trumpy, Booby Clark, Ross Browner, Eddie Edwards, the whole crew. Those are the guys I kind of grew up watching. And I remember the first two Super Bowls they were in. The first one, 1981, still can't believe the Bengals made the Super Bowl. 1988, of course, that was a fun year with Boomer Esiason and Icky Woods. And boy, 32 years later, good God.
Yeah.
I'm getting old, man. But I'm going Bengals. I don't think the magic carpet ride is going to end here, guys. They won in Tennessee, right? Number one seed in the AFC. They go to Kansas City and they're losing, 21-3 or whatever in the first half, and then they come back and win the ball game. I think so much mojo here, so much good vibrations, if you will, with Burrow and, of course, Ja'Marr Chase's teammate at LSU. I think a very underrated defense. That's what nobody talks about. If, you know, we talked about quarterbacks here, obviously. The storylines gravitate toward that position for obvious reasons. But this Bengals defense, I think, largely anonymous. But, again, that was the key to beating the Chiefs, right? Shut down Patrick Mahomes in the second half. It wasn't an accident, obviously. And on that note, Brian, speaking of Bengals defense, I want one Lou Lamoriello. I don't know how to say his last name. The old Purdue defensive.
Anarumo.
Give us one story of Lou. One time you talked about him walking back from West Lafayette High School after practice. You get any other good Lou stories? What kind of guy was he? Staten Island guy, right?
He has a great Staten Island accent, for one thing. Big Yankees fan, which is, you know, the fastest way to my heart. But he was just kind of a grinder. I mean, he was a guy who was never really looking for his next job until it became clear one of his guys was going to get a coordinator job in the NFL and bring him with him. And so the last couple of years, I think he stuck around when it went from Joe Tiller to Danny Hope because he knew his guy. I can't remember his name, Kevin something or other, who ended up becoming the coordinator in Cincinnati or Miami, one or the other. I think he stuck around Purdue when Joe Tiller retired because he thought that was a year or two away. But he always was just a guy who kind of kept his head down, just kind of did his job, didn't solicit a lot of attention for himself. And sometimes guys like that don't move up very quickly. You know, this is a guy who went from like the U.S. Merchant Marine Academy to Marshall to an Ivy League school. He did everything before he got to Purdue. He coached at every level. If you go from the Ivy League to coaching Marshall, that is both ends of the spectrum. So he had a lot of experience. Players really liked him. He was kind of a hard ass, really demanding guy. Learned from quite a demanding guy himself in Phil Elmation, who was one of the all-time most colorful characters in the history of Purdue football coaching staffs. But just a guy I'll always remember as just sort of a, you know, proverbially salt of the earth sort of guy who really worked to get to the position he's been in. And I think he interviewed for the Giants head coaching job.
Yeah, he did.
Which had to be a huge deal for him because he was a huge Giants fan growing up. Just really, really happy for him. He was always good to us. He was always good to me. Just a good guy and the sort of guy you like to see be successful.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have the advantage of Wikipedia here looking at, you pulled that out. Merchant Marine, 92 to 94 at Harvard, 95 to 2000. And he did spend a year with the New York Giants as a defensive backs coach before coming to the Bengals at Purdue, of course, from 2004 to 2011. I like that. I like Marcus Bailey. I always thought one of the class acts, really good football player, overcame a lot of stuff at Purdue to be as good as he was. You root for guys like that to have their chance to win. Ricardo Allen as well, even though both those guys will play limited roles tomorrow, though I think Bailey will be on the field and special teams. So going to be interesting to watch from that standpoint. Go ahead, Brian.
Just that one story about Lou Anarumo too, I think Tom had mentioned, was there was that year, and they had a lot of injuries back in those days, and they had a lot of injuries at corner. And I can't remember who it was who got hurt in front of him, but they had to move Ray Williams in season.
Ray Williams,
from wide receiver to cornerback.
In 2005,
They didn't just have to move him to cornerback. They had to move him to starting cornerback because they were so depleted. And that was right around the time I think they had to move, was it Cliff Averill? They had to move to defensive end on the fly too. I don't know if it was the same year. I don't know if it was the same year. But back in those days, there was a little bit of a kerfuffle over the conditions of Purdue's outdoor playing fields. They were quite often looking like they were just bombed by a drone. And so because, you know, Joe Tiller sometimes liked to draw attention to some of the things that, you know, Purdue was not doing for him, or some of the things that Purdue probably should have been doing for whoever their football coach would have been, because a sound playing surface would seem like a non-negotiable. Purdue would go to West Lafayette High School a block away on that old field that I'm not convinced was in any better shape than Purdue's practice.
It wasn't. Leslie Field.
Correct. So they would have to walk that block cross Northwestern Avenue to come to and from practice. And I would always remember when Purdue would break up practice back in those days, when Ray Williams was learning the position in season, Lou Anarumo would go grab Ray Williams and they would walk that block and a half back together. And the whole way Anarumo would be talking about concepts and just coaching him while they're crossing Northwestern Avenue. And I just thought that spoke to a coach who was just trying to maximize every opportunity he could get to coach his guys. That was somebody who had a good enough relationship with his players, that Ray Williams wasn't looking at him like he was crazy, that he just wanted to walk back to practice from practice in peace, things like that. That's always what I kind of remember about Lou Anarumo more than anything.
Good storyline and a guy that definitely earned his stripes. And he was kind of the quiet guy on that staff, as I recall, too. When you have a Hagan, you have a Brock Spack, those types of individuals running around. He just did his job, and he's done it well, and he's going to do it on the world's biggest stage. It's coming about 6:30 p.m. Eastern time on Sunday. All right, guys, we're going to put a close. Let Brian get off to talk some basketball with Purdue Plus. What's that?
I have 6 minutes.
All right, well, you're good. And I want to thank our sponsor, and I'll thank Tom and Brian as well. Also, a reminder that you can – our sponsor, Union Club Hotel and the Boiler Up Bar. Big programming note, I think it's March the 3rd. Brian and I are scheduled to do a Thursday night live, Facebook Live at the Boiler Up Bar. But that is – we'll keep you posted. But the Boiler Up Bar is a great place for that iconic cocktail, and you can cheer on the Purdue with that. It really is a cool bar there and a great spot to if you're on campus, whether you're watching a game or just hanging out, great spot. So, guys, thanks for checking in, all of you. Thanks for listening and watching, and we'll look forward to next week. Purdue will play again on Sunday next week against Rutgers, so we'll probably do our Saturday simulcast again on Saturday. But have a great week, everybody. Thanks for watching and listening, and we'll look forward to more of the same next week.